particularly on coral. With over 270 scientific works, his work is highly cited. From Perth, Australia, Malcolm McCullough, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
And welcome to all your listeners here. And we're in for a very hot day down here in Perth at the moment. We're in the middle of a heat wave again.
And we have no winter here in Canada to speak of. It's been quite warm. It's very strange. All right, so your analysis of Humboldt sea sponges created a lot of heat in climate science circles, but I want to go straight to what you found missing in the official story. What does the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, consider the baseline for pre-industrial times, the beginning of human warming in the atmosphere as far as they're concerned?
So, as far as they're concerned, it was from 1850 to 1900. And that's based mainly on the available instrumental records, in particular sea surface temperature records. And at the time that was set, which is not so long ago, just a few years after the Paris Agreement, that was all the information that was available. So it was called a pragmatic placing the baseline at this point because there was no other choice.
Instead, though, you went back to the 1700s and measured temperatures not with mercury in a thermometer, but in a type of sea sponge. Would you tell us about that?
So it's also like another thermometer, actually, the way it works. So these are calcifying sea sponges. They make a calcium carbonate skeleton. And when they do that, they incorporate another element. In addition to calcium carbonate, they incorporate other trace elements. And one of them is strontium. And we know for many, a lot of work is that the incorporation of strontium into calcium carbonate is temperature dependent. And we know that it's very well founded. So when they make the skeleton, they also have a thermometer working away, and that's the strontium-calcium ratio in the skeleton. And it's just a matter of reading that signal to get the temperature out of the seawater that they grew in. And that's essentially what we did.
Well, let's look at the history of warming as told by the sponge record. It shows warming in the 1700s, a slight bit, but then a strange cooling in the early 1800s. Tell us what and why that is.
Well, that's actually a good confirmation of our proxy, because we know that in 1815 in particular, there was the largest volcanic eruption that yet occurred. That was the Tambora eruption, and it caused a year without a summer. There was cooling right across the northern hemisphere. And the reason is the volcanic aerosols induced this cooling. They reflected heat coming in from the sun. So although it was triggered by a volcano, it was an atmospheric radiative forced cooling. And it's well known that now, of course, that volcanic eruptions cause cooling, but they're only short-lived. And that's exactly what we see on our record. So that sort of confirms that when you go back where you know a big event is, it's really a marker event, if you like. We can reproduce it.
But the age of coal burning was well underway before 1850. Steamships were replacing sailing. There were coal-powered railways. And although those emissions were relatively low compared to modern times, there was carbon dioxide added to the atmosphere. How much early warming, not counted at all by the IPCC, did your sponges record?
Well, actually, it's not a huge difference. This is a little subtlety. And I should say the warming, in addition to coal burning, what we call fossil fuel, there's also land use changes. There's been horrendous land use changes, and that's also added to emissions early on especially. So with our record, it's quite flat from virtually. There's a little, you point out, slight increase in temperature, but less than a tenth of a degree from 1700. If you just overlook the cooling, just go and look, we can see it's a very flat line almost. And then starts to move upwards in about the mid-1860s. So there's actually very little warming up to the mid-1860s. But from 1860 to 1900, we see this about just over 0.3 of a degree, 0.3 degrees warming. And the IPCC didn't have that. They missed that. But in addition, I should say to your listeners, their baseline from 1850 to 1900 is too warm. When you look at it, in the oceans in particular, you'll notice that it's actually warmer than the early 1900s. It's a combination of those two facts. They missed a little bit of warming. Oh, but it's not a little. It's a significant 0.3 degrees warming from 1860 to 1900. And then they had a baseline that was even higher still, about another 0.3 degrees. So the combination of those two facts made the overall offset for the oceans about 0.6 degrees. And then when you add the land records in, it drops down to about 0.5 degree difference.
As your paper points out, science has unresolved problems. In the early 1900s, the sea was cooling compared to land, you say. And then since the 1990s, land temperatures warm much faster than the sea. You write, in fact, in the late 20th century, with land air temperatures now increasing at nearly twice the rate of the surface oceans, regardless of the ENSO phase, what is going on? Why is the land warming faster now? Do we know?
Yeah, we do. Most of the models, we don't know exactly, but there's kind of when the climate models are run, you see warming occurring in the high latitude northern hemisphere around the permafrost areas of around Soviet Union and Canada, those areas, and also a little bit of extra warming down in the equivalent part of the southern hemisphere, but that's minor. Well, around the Antarctic area, but that's kind of slightly different. So the global models are showing this recent increased warming on the land. And the fundamental difference, actually, between with us and IPCC is because they got their baseline wrong by about half a degree, and then because they normalized that 1850-1900 point, they forced the land to be... And the land records look overall pretty good, pretty consistent with ours, but although much more variable. They had the land starting to warm, as you mentioned, early in the 1900s. Ours stays together with the ocean. So the land and the ocean warm together in our reconstruction all the way to about 1990. So it really only breaks away from the 1990s. So it's what our observations now say, well, there's something different about the land in the late 20th century. And as I just said, we think that's high latitude warming, but you can imagine there's been lots of other things going on as well that's causing the land now to warm much faster.
And your paper finds climate sensitivity is dropping, becoming half what it was before 1980. I'm not sure I even understand what that means. What does it mean?
Well, it's when I say sensitivity, that means sensitivity to the CO2 emissions, right? So when you calculate the temperature change, if you have a 10 ppm increase in CO2, how much is that equivalent to in temperature? That sensitivity has leveled off since 1990. But there's kind of some theoretical reasons for that. When you start putting CO2 in the atmosphere, it does start to slowly saturate as you get higher and higher concentrations. And so the amount of extra radiative heating you get from the additional amount of CO2 isn't the same amount as if you started at much lower concentration levels. So that's probably part of an explanation for that. But that's still being looked at, that issue. But actually the remarkable, an interesting thing is that the oceans now seem to be warming very, very constantly and steadily from about early 1960s onwards right up to our present day at a constant rate with time. Yet our CO2 emissions have been going up, especially the rate of emissions have been going up. So this is, we think, partly this saturation effect, which then gives has the thing of the actual sensitivity for CO2 declining slightly. And so that's the explanation for that.
Well, that's almost a bit of good news in a sad sort of way. Well, but as you say, I mean, during 2023 and onward this year, sea surface temperatures are literally off the chart hotter. They're above every year ever recorded, and yes, we've got El Nino now, but that ocean heat wave seemed to start during a cooler La Nina event earlier last year. What do you make of this, Malcolm?
That's very interesting. First off, you have to, your listeners, remember all these events which we call ENSO events, El Nino Southern Oscillation. Each one is a bit different, right? Every event you can see has slightly different characteristics. So our 2023 one, the nearest I think you can see was in 1998, but it looks a little bit different. So there's one explanation, well, it's just a variation in the type of El Nino. But actually in Australia here, we're now talking about heading back into a La Nina again, and we've had lots and lots of rainfall on the East Coast, and that's been unexpected in a way. Well, no one knows the answer. I'm just sort of trying to work our way through it. But it doesn't quite make sense, as you said, that it's just due to this starting of an El Nino phase. There seems to be something else going on. Well, it could be what we call a tipping point, that we've passed some tipping point in our climate system, and now we're seeing all the things we've expected, like enhanced warming, Not only have we saw earlier in the land, which we just spoke about, but now where the oceans are changing their behaviour. That's one possible explanation. You know, it may be, but we'll know about that in another couple of years, no, 1 or 2 years, as to whether we go back onto that long-term ocean trend that I spoke about of pretty constant warming. Or there's a third hypothesis that there was an undersea eruption off Tonga last year, which put a huge amount of water vapour into the atmosphere just for a short term. And people are speculating that extra water vapour means the atmosphere can carry much more heat, and therefore that's causing that sort of very unusual warming. So we don't know. I hope, of course, that it's just a transient, you know, departure, that we return back to our long-term trend, because that's actually, as you say, having the oceans, they're the big heat sink. If they start changing their behaviour, then that's very, very serious consequences. And we may in fact be, you know, in the midst now of sort of going through a tipping point or regime change in the way the climate system's behaving.
Please consider supporting Radio EcoShock. Find out more at our website, ecoshock.org. You can write me at any time. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from the University of Western Australia Oceans Institute. Our guest is Emeritus Professor Malcolm McCullough. He says humans already warmed the planet beyond 1.5 degrees C, and 2 degrees is just a few years away. Malcolm, sadly, Australia has become famous for deadly wildfires. Canada just blew up all our fire records this year. It was amazing.
Yep.
Why do you think these fire and heat waves are becoming more extreme almost every year?
Yeah, well, I think this is part of the fact that the land's now warming twice the rate of the oceans. You know, so the warming rates on the land are much faster, and they've been doing that now for about over three decades. And we've just got right now, as we speak, in Victoria, which we have now some of the worst, again, another set of extremely bad bushfires. Actually, they've ironically had some good, fair bit of rainfall way earlier, then a very intense summer heat, early summer heat, dried everything out, and now we've had unusually strong winds, over 100 kilometres an hour, and these bushfires are just uncontrollable. There's no way that you could do very much preventative work and just have to sit back and wait for the weather conditions to change. So I think it's basically because the land's been warming much faster on average than it did before. It almost looks like twice as fast since the 1990s, and that's the inevitable consequence. Here in Australia, it's a very, very serious. Although I should say a lot of our native vegetation is partly adapted to bushfires, but it's not so intense bushfires. The very, very intense bushfires are now just decimating the countryside and all the bushland. In fact, I live close to a park here, and we always worry about a bushfire getting started.
We've had some fires here so intense that the soil has been sterilized, and then if the fire comes back within 5 years, it kills off all the seedlings, and then you get nothing. Anyway, one criticism of your study is choosing sponge measurements from a small area in the Caribbean to estimate global temperature conditions. Why do you say it works?
Okay, well, I've explained why the sponges work, because they actually carry a thermometer. The other thing that I didn't say is that compared to previous ocean measurements, the sponges live in what's called the ocean mix layer. So this is the surface ocean, part of the surface ocean that separates the atmosphere from the sort of interior ocean. It can be over 100 metres thick, but it sees all the warming signals coming from the atmosphere. But it's much more stable than the upper 1 to 2 metres, which actually are part of this layer. So it has much less variability. And the sponges calcify very slowly and tend to average out seasonal changes. So this is a very low variability part of the oceans, but senses the long-term changes especially. So, okay, we have ocean, so that's called our sensors sitting in this ocean mixed layer, which is a huge advantage over the sea surface temperature measurements, you know, that where they were throwing a bucket over the side of a ship. You know, no more, you know, half a metre deep, pull up the water, stick the bucket on the deck and try and measure it. Because actually, as your listeners may know, that if you go swimming in the oceans that particularly, or even on lakes, that the upper 1 metre can be very different temperature to that waters below it, right? So you can easily get this skin effect, and that's probably partly contaminated some of these records. So that's why the sponges, they're from the ocean mix layer, a big volume of water, that helps a lot. The second reason is that your listeners could ask, well, what's so special about the Caribbean? Why is it working so well there? Well, when you look at all the instrumental records, for example, that the last 50 years of records are very, very good. And you can easily calculate, and this is what they're doing, they calculate the average temperature of all those records. You can also sort of what we call invert the calculation, say, well, which regions look most like the average, right? It's easy to do. And this is done quite a lot because there's some processes like where the ENSO is, or for the Canadians, you might know about AMOC, the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation. It's a very big event off northeastern Canada. The Caribbean is one of those regions where it looks like it follows the average, right? And there has to be many regions of the ocean whose temperature changes are proportional to the average change. And you can it's a straightforward calculation to do. And when I say, I'm using my words very carefully, proportional to the global average, not necessarily equal to the global average, but within a constant, they're proportional. And I should say proportional to the surface ocean warming, not the warming of the whole ocean. It's only the surface ocean, and that's what the Caribbean is. And we were able to easily check that. We just took our records and compared it to the global average of the instrumental records for the last 60 years, and they agree perfectly with a very, very high confidence level. In fact, the only slight departures were these ENSO events, because when you're in the deeper ocean mix layer, you don't see the El Niños so much as well. And as your listeners may know, the heart of the El Niño is in the eastern or central Pacific, whereas the Caribbean is isolated in the Atlantic, and nor does it see the Atlantic AMOC phenomena, which is way up, mainly up in the northern Atlantic. Anyway, that's the reasons, that's my answers to those criticisms.
Well, considering what you found in this natural record, how much heat should be added to the numbers presented by the IPCC and other big climate models?
Well, for the oceans, if you're just considering the oceans alone, they should add 0.6 degrees, roughly. That's within 0.1 degree. If you take what we call the global warming, the total warming, which is the land plus the sea, you only need to add, you have to add half degree. And the reason it's less is that the land, conventionally, that's considered about just around 30% of the signal, the ocean 70%, just based on surface area. So when people talk about the global warming or such and such, it's the combined land and ocean. And as I mentioned, it's the ocean record that's been out by this larger amount. So what that means then is the global warming signal, you just have to add half a degree to it. Well, it's easy to do. So when people talk about, oh, well, are we going to cross the 1.5 degree threshold, really you've got to change. So what they mean now, are we going to cross the 2 degree threshold? Or when are we going to cross the 2.5? Well, you just have to keep adding 0.5 onto the IPCC estimate. So it's an easy translation to do.
Some scientists say humans started slow warming thousands of years ago by agriculture, deforestation, and land change, as you mentioned. But now you move the common definition of pre-industrial back to, pre-industrial time, before 1750.
Yep.
Is that a change of definition, or does it matter a lot for where we are and where it goes?
No, it matters tremendously, because if we're talking about warming relative to the natural state, i.e. relative to the pre-industrial, and models are run for the consequences, they're tuned to the stable pre-industrial, right? So when we're looking at the increment above the real, there can only be one pre-industrial state, right? I mean, and you want to get as close as you can to the start of warming to define it. And that change now is half a degree difference to the IPCC 1850 to 1900, I put in quotation marks, pre-industrial, because it's not really, right? The actual pre-industrial state, which models are always referenced to, is now shifted, where an extra half a degree warming above the real pre-industrial state. And that's important, because that's a stable state. So everything, when you're talking about all these effects, what's the increment away from stability? And the further you get away from stable states, that's when we can expect all these consequences, which is what we're now seeing.
Just on a personal note, Malcolm McCullough, you are known for coral research, but this new work is about a particular type of creature, the sclerosponge. Are these animals? What do they look like? And do they have some similarities to coral reefs?
Actually, very many. You know, they're probably way back in. They're a much more ancient organism. They make calcium carbonate skeleton, like corals do. But they, because they grow so slowly, actually, they don't depend on light. So they're living in this kind of dark, called a mesophotic zone. I don't want to get too technical, but they're living below where corals are. So they're kind of an interesting, they don't actually make reefs, so to speak, but they kind of are a part of the tropical coral reef system in a way, but the deeper parts that you don't normally see. In fact, if you go on scuba, you have to go a bit deeper than regular scuba. You can see the, and you have a torch, you can see the bright orange skeletons. I mean tissues. They're living like hemispheres attached to underneath the roofs of caves, where they have little competition from the coral reefs. I mean, a coral reef can, of course, the shallow water ones grow so much faster that these guys just can't keep up. But the reason I'm working on them, they're all very similar. You know, we're talking about a calcium carbonate skeleton. You're talking about using chemical proxies to try and trace their history, in particular their temperature history. So from my research perspective, they're a sort of a natural kind of archive to go look at and interrogate more closely.
And why do you think the reaction to your study, some from well-known scientists, has been almost dismissive?
Well, I have to say, some actually didn't read the paper. One thing I know, right? I think the other thing is people are used to thinking, oh, how much variability there is in these surface, coral reefs, for example, that every reef's different from the next. And so when I say, you know, the Caribbean gives us a global kind of signal, that's not an intuitive outcome, right? And you have to actually read through and go look carefully at all the reasonings that I went through just then with your listeners, why this is. So that's part of it. And also, the other reason is people who've worked, say, for example, on tree rings, right, or any terrestrial archive, know that you can't extrapolate too much terrestrially from one place to the other because each place is so different. And yet a third reason is what we call these vital effects or biological controls on the proxies, how they modulate it. In corals, that biological control is reasonably strong, and one of my other kind of well-known pieces of work, I was able to show that the calcification of corals, they didn't just calcify from ordinary seawater, they calcified from seawater that was modulated with higher pH, so that, for example, you've got to be careful, you know, they're more immune to ocean acidification than what we thought. But the sponges, these deep sponges, because they're so ancient, they calcify differently and they have much less biological control on the we call the calcifying environment where they're actually making the skeleton. Almost they have little control, actually, so that means they're reflecting directly the seawater. Now that's kind of somewhat unusual, but I was able to demonstrate it, and it was sort of pretty well known because another proxy, carbon isotopes, looks very much like the seawater changes. They're the scientific reasons why perhaps people, if not fully aware, but I think there's also an underlying thing that the IPCC is sort of, it's really a whole groups of scientists who get together and write these reports, and people perhaps get a little bit too wrapped up in that and sort of lose their sort of dispassionate ability, which all scientists we have to have, is we just have to assess data very dispassionately, don't have any biases, just see, you know, just interpret it as we see it and do it honestly and in a kind of a rigorous way, and don't let too much of other people's interpretations in the past prejudice us. We have to do it objectively, and I think I've tried to do that objectively as possible. I mean, I don't have any kind of preference. I mean, you know, we're studying where we live, so we all have our biases, but what I'm saying, I think, is some of the biases and prejudices of the IPCC have coloured those views of other so-called experts. I don't like to say that, but unfortunately that's how I think it's evolving.
So, Malcolm, is the speed of warming increasing, and how hot do you think Earth will be, say, by 2035?
Okay, that's an excellent question, actually, because I've looked at, you know, the way to answer it is to say, well, it depends on the rates of emissions, right? You know, if the emission rates remain high, then that'll, we expect warming to be going very, very rapidly. Now, during our COVID era, you know, which is not, actually we're still in it almost, the rates of emissions tended to plateau off, right? So they're at, in the units, they were about, per year, about 10 gigatons of carbon per year, plus or minus a little, you know. And the fact is, that high level remains. There's not much evidence that it's turning down. We've got to go from that 10 number down to zero. That's emissions per year. If we get it down to zero, that then means the atmosphere can stabilise. So, Wade, if we leave the emissions even at the constant number of 10 gigatons per year, things will go pretty rapidly. We'll certainly pass, we'll probably pass...
Past 2 degrees?
At 2 degrees, yep, that's exactly right. The next one, the next 2.5 will probably come in the mid-230s if we leave things alone. You know, if we keep having these super high emission rates. But I've looked at it carefully. If you start to say, let's turn down these emission rates and let's start doing it right now, we can certainly stop the temperatures. I think they'll get just above 2. You can keep them down to just over 2 degrees if we started really rapid reductions, like 10% per year. So that 10 number, if we took off one unit off of 1 gigaton per year, in the next 10 years you get to net zero, then you can probably just escape the 2 degrees. Well, you'll get just a bit above 2 degrees. I don't think that's realistic, actually. That's not going to happen. There are some reductions, you know, like maybe 50% of current by the mid-2030s. We can probably, well, you know, don't get above 2.3. I think it's going to be a struggle. Whether we get above 2.5 now is totally dependent on what we do with emissions, for sure. And so it's up to us, I guess, society globally, to decide how rapidly, you know, we're going to decarbonise. And that'll dictate not only our future, but the future for our grandkids and their grandkids, because the CO2, once it's in the atmosphere, is there for tens of thousands of years. So it's going to, you know, we're setting the kind of agenda for the Earth's climate now for the next, certainly the next 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years. So
it's like the ancient Egyptians make some decision with their civilization, and we have to live with it now. That's how long it will go, and much longer, yeah, perhaps. Yeah. From Perth, Australia, we've been speaking with well-known ocean researcher Dr. Malcolm McCullough. He leads the paper titled 300 Years of Sclerosponge Thermometry Shows Global Warming Has Exceeded 1.5 degrees C. It was published February 5 in Nature Climate Change. This paper is open access. It is free to you. Or you can check out Malcolm's article in The Conversation. I'll put links to all of that in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Malcolm, thank you for sharing your work with us.
And thank you very much for the opportunity too. And it's been a pleasure. And all the best in Canada. I think we'll all need it across the globe.
Microsoft Copilot pretends to succeed but cheats and fails. It has limited uses. The icon for a Windows AI showed up on my screen. I tried it on the search Donald Trump and Ressentiment. The results were impressive, I will say, with citations. But 5 out of the 6 paragraphs cited just 2 sources, meaning Copilot paraphrased from 1 peer-reviewed article and a piece of journalism. That's it. A couple of people had their work used, but no credit mentioned in the text, and certainly no royalties or pay. They just take it and make it their own, as any failing college student learns to do. Getting beyond the text ideas, Copilot floundered. I asked the number of listeners on SoundCloud for Radio EcoShock, where we post every week. The figures returned were flattering, but completely untrue, up to 10 times larger than the obvious totals that SoundCloud gives you. Copilot made it up. I asked how many views on the Radio EcoShock YouTube channel. Copilot returned the same false numbers as for the first question, but one of the top listed programs in their AI result appeared on radio, but never on YouTube. It was a total fabrication. How many people will rely on this major brand AI and lose face or money or something else? Too bad, but this ChatGPT-4 artificial intelligence is too artificial. not credible, not even trustworthy. That's my take. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for staying tuned and caring about our world.